Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
どこにいるのかな。見えないよ。
あ、こんなところ。
Friends, I did it. After 400 plus hours, my game clock says 442 now. I got every single achievement in Into the Breach, and now I'm still playing it with the Legendary Secret Squad, which is really hard, really difficult. So suffice it to say, I am fully and completely ensnared in a sort of completionist fever dream with this game, and there is still no end in sight. And I am Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 165. Joining me today are Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Austin Walker.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good, and we're talking about completionism in games this week.
Things are terrible. My kid is like horribly sick, and I might get that disease at any moment, and Austin is barely standing up. Things are terrible.
He's not standing up.
Might be completing my life currently. It's just I got all the collectibles.
You got every virus. You got to catch them all, you know. Rob, how about you? Are you doing okay over there?
I mean, better than these two, I guess. Patrick, I thought this was like a juvenile disease that adults were not susceptible to.
So my kid has hand, foot, and mouth disease, which sounds like something from the Middle Ages that is going to kill your kid 2 hours, 24 hours later. Adults can get it, and it's not common. But so if you don't know what hand, foot, and mouth disease, it's called that because that's where like the rashes and like scabbing appears. Because, like, you get these, like, really gross rashes, and then they scab over and then, you know, clears up. And it appears in your hand, foot, and in your mouth, like, gross sores that are, like, are not fun. Apparently adults can get it. And the let me read from my Facebook when I mentioned that my kid had it, and we had a particularly bad case of it. Hold on one second. Here we go. Loading. Yes. I won't name my sources. I had this as a 32-year-old man and wished death upon myself.
Content warning for this podcast.
The same person found blisters under every fingernail and toenail. Why are you even reading this? Just run from your house. Source number two. I peeled the soles off my feet.
Gotta stop talking. We
in
have
one
to stop.
Peel.
I know
very
we're trying not to interrupt each other anymore, but I'm interrupting you. That is it.
Content. So,
listen, Danica
warning.
Left this week. We can't have violence to feet in this podcast.
Yeah, feet are sanctified now on Waypoint Radio. I am very sorry to hear that. And the world is also falling apart. So, I guess in honor of everything terrible and bad, we should do our best to soldier on and talk about games that we can never, ever, ever seem to stop playing. there have been a few things this week. There has been the sort of really interesting story a reader pointed out about Bloodborne, about people still finding new things in Bloodborne after 3 years, almost 3.5 years at this point. And that had to do with Chalice Dungeons and sort of a glitch that was keeping very high-level players out of certain configurations of Chalice Dungeons. I always find these kinds of stories very charming because it's sort of like somebody really loves something, right? Somebody's very passionate about something, a group of people are very passionate about something, and they're continually finding secrets and learning things about a game that are maybe somewhat unknown even to the people who made the game, which I find to be a weird and arcane and beautiful thing, especially when it comes to Bloodborne.
Well, it's like the game is continuing to pay off your investment in it. Like, there aren't many games that I've gotten into that far, but, like, You know, years ago, I got really fixated on, I really liked playing Max Payne 2 for some reason in college. Like, that became one of my comfort games. It was the equivalent of like a dumb 80s action movie I would sort of throw on and just watch. But the thing is, like, even games like that, a lot of times there's just like little conversations you've never triggered or never heard. And so even the like eighth, ninth time through a game, you're still like, oh, I've never heard that before. I've never seen that. And that's a really great feeling.
Yeah, Austin.
It's a mode of playing that I think it's funny you say Max Payne 2, because I think it's like in that same, you know, in that from the SNES, really, I would say like from the PS1 era through the start of like the 360 era is when I was my most like completionist gamer ass gamer, and largely because I felt enabled to do it. I think about things like unlockable characters in Tekken or Soul Calibur or any fighting game, alternate endings, lots of unlockable things that required difficult challenges, things like the Resident Evil 2 characters that you had to unlock, the alternate endings in Silent Hill, all of those things that were like, there's so many little secrets in this thing. And half the fun was finding them for yourself, but half the fun for me at the time was just like having the FAQ up or having the magazine spread out in front of me that said to get the UFO ending, all I had to do was XYZ, and then like spending a weekend doing that. Something about games changed, I think. Like, I think partially... something that the world changed, which is like one of the reasons I was trying to beat the game with every character in Tekken was to see all of their ending videos. And it turns out in 2018 or in 2010, 2011, 2012, I more and more was able to go to the internet to just see those videos, which meant the collecting was less, you know, important in some way.
Oh. Sorry, I just hit my pop screen. I apologize. Oh. I was so excited to raise my hand. I hit the pop screen. there was a question, and we're not going to questions yet, but there is a sort of framing question that I thought might be super useful and be a sort of fun exercise for us to do. And that is for each of us to kind of say a game where completionism hit us really hard, like a specific game where it hit us super hard, and then one where it didn't. Like something where maybe other people got super, super into it, but we were like, I don't know, I spent 2 hours. I'm good. I've had enough of this. And I'm wondering, like, maybe we could kind of go around the table and sort of share that. I know you just mentioned Tekken for sure, Austin, but do you have one where perhaps other people got super, super in and, you know, you didn't?
I mean, I think a lot of open world games, like all of my friends were trying to get all of the, I think about GTA 3 or Vice City or San Andreas, where it was like everyone wanted to get all 100 packages and unlock all of the special equipment and then get all of the unlockable or like the bulletproof Hummer or whatever, right? Like there were certain things you could get either as rewards in the game or that in GTA 3, Vice City, and San Andreas, you could kind of glitch your way into getting, where like in this mission, it turns out that this car you have is bulletproof and fireproof and explosion proof. And if you like fail the mission just so, it won't despawn out of the world and you can put it in your garage and keep it. And what I would do is like pick one or two of those things or like a certain number of packages that I want. Like, oh, I want to get 40 packages because you get the rocket launcher for that or whatever. Like, that's the reward I need. I don't need all of them. And so I was always very tied to results. Like, I wanted collectibles. I wanted challenges. I wanted those things. But to get something else to then return to the kind of main through line of the game with and like play with. You know, I was never the sort of person who was just collecting for the sake of collecting. There always had to be some reward.
For sure. Patrick, how about you? What's a game that it's hooks into you and then something that was not?
I've never been that person. I've written about this a lot over the years. This is true as an adult, it was true as a kid. I find collection for collection's sake to be like a very boring endeavor. Like I need a carrot at the end of it. Like, I guess similar to Austin. But often, like, even in like Grand Theft Auto and things like that, like, I remember, yeah, I was in similar circles where people want to get the packages, but like, it wasn't like, it was both not fun to do and the game didn't help you at all in doing so. Like, I get really frustrated in games that have collectible aspects that don't like, attempt to help the player to do that. Like I like at the end of a game, it should unlock a tool that's like, hey, I mean, here's all this shit. If you want to go find it, like, here's an easy way to go do it. If you just want to like dink around the world, but at the point that you're like looking up YouTube videos and like pulling up facts and like screenshots or like go to this corner and this is how you get this thing. Like I don't find that particularly compelling. I find that to be like the kind of bulk, sort of like fluff the game designers put in games because they want you to stick around, but there's actually no satisfying thing. And in some ways, they're exploiting the psychology of players in a way that like I try and push back on. I think Skyrim was maybe the closest I ever got to something like that. And it was mostly because by the time I finished like my 100 hours in it, I had gotten most of the achievements, and I was like, oh, okay, like maybe I'll just try and get the last couple, just like, because it'd be interesting to have one game where I've actually, you know, achieved all of the achievements. But one of them glitched out and I couldn't get it. And I said, well, fuck this. Like, this is why I don't do this stuff to begin with.
But Patrick, there was never like an RPG where you were like, I am going to get every single side quest and hear every nugget of narrative in this fucker. Like,
I mean, I like Final Fantasy, like when I was a kid playing like Final Fantasy VII, where I didn't have other games to play. But like, I consider that sort of backed into a corner because I didn't have other things to do, as opposed to like maxing out the clock to get Knights of the Round Table in Final Fantasy VII was more like a product of circumstance. Was like, oh, it's the summer, I have unlimited time, I like Final Fantasy VII, you have to basically put in unlimited time to get these chocobos to fuck so I can get that spell and then beat the shit out of Sephiroth.
I don't know FF7 as well as I thought I did.
there's chocobo fucking.
There are games where I've done that, but it was, I look back on that more as like, oh, like if I had the options I had now, like I wouldn't have done any of those things. That was more, I've got Final Fantasy VII, or I've got Final Fantasy VII, or I could like try and get get Tofu in Resident Evil 2 again, but I just wasn't good enough to do it.
The reframing of it by Rob as like side quest stuff, the one for me, the actual one for me, that even now I would still try to 100% or like complete all of the side quests. 100% is such a vague thing with RPGs, because like, does that mean getting every weapon? Does that mean getting, you know what I mean? But that I would complete my mission board is Mass Effect 1. I've replayed Mass Effect 1 two or three times. It's the most I've ever replayed a single game, probably, that isn't like a beat 'em up or something, you know, isn't a single sitting game. And I don't know how to play that game in a way that isn't completing all the side quests. Like, all of them, even the ones I know how they end, even the ones where I'm doing them the same way I did them before, even the ones where I know that I don't think that they're particularly good quests, I still, even all of the Mako stuff on the different planets, like, all of it, I complete everything 100%. All right, I haven't played that game in 5 years all the way through, but if I pick it up again today, I would want to do it all the way through. And that is probably the only game that's ever done that for me. And actually, including collectibles, including all of the, like, the whatever Space Marine dog tags and the what are they? What species is Liara again? Why am I blanking?
Asari.
All the Asari relics that you find. All of the little collectibles. They give you maybe like a little hint of narrative, but like even some of them are just fucking collectibles. I just like, because I wanted to be like, all right, I'm fucking done with this planet. There is nothing else on this planet. It's done. I can move on. And that is my one real completionist mark in my life, I would say.
Awesome. Rob, how about you? Rob's making a face.
How far do I want to get into this? Okay. So the thing is, I'm all about like getting all that narrative. I want to hear all the story dialogue. I want to see all the character relationships that are possible and like talk to people, you know, just see, you know, what kind of rich world and narrative a game builds. Which brings us to the Witcher 1 sex cards.
Sure.
Sure does.
So...
Oh, I should have mentioned, that's also what I got obsessed with.
Yeah. Great. I'm glad I'm not alone on this one. So The Witcher 1 was a really interesting game and a really weird game and a really flawed game in a lot of ways. But one of its quirks is that in the middle of its like grimdark, low fantasy aesthetic and tone, or maybe not in spite of it, but because of it, every time Geralt slept with someone in the world of The Witcher 1, instead of like a sex scene, you got a little like trading card, usually featuring the nude portrait of the character that you just slept with. And there were a lot, like more than a baseball team's worth of of cards you collect in this
Geralt.
Game.
Geralt.
You know, well, you know, the thing
don't
is,
slut shame Geralt.
Or rather, know. Rob.
Rob!
Well, so at first I was like, this is very tacky and doesn't agree at all with my sensibilities about the way this game should be played. But then I was like, and yet there's these cards, and you collect them. And also, usually to collect these cards, to sort of spark these sort of romantic encounters with these characters, there's usually some other story shit you've got to go through. And so, you know, after the third or fourth, like, random milkmaid in various villages in this world, I was like...
Well, that's... I pulled a list up, and I expected to be... it's like Triss. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know who Triss is. You know...
The cat in the Triss portrait is...
How do you just have that on deck, Rob? My point
this
is...
hilarious!
Okay.
It's the point in is his like, deck! That's why it's
Triss,
on deck.
Vesna. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Good. Abigail. But then it does just become half elf's romance card. The prostitute's romance card. Noble. These characters aren't even names, Rob.
Didn't spend long enough time with them to find out.
Well, look, I mean, they sort of, but they you may not have known their names, but they were sort of like important characters to sort of give the perspective of an entire faction, you know, elvish resistance fighters hiding in the woods. You had a sort of ship passing in the night encounter with one of them, in the process of which you came to understand their struggle a little bit better.
Okay.
So really I was building the rich lore of The Witcher as I sort of built my deck. But the thing is...
You read it for the story, the articles. I get it. You were playing it for the articles.
Yeah, and I started getting really, like... The vampire one is actually really tricky to get, and that was like, all right, it's walkthrough time. Because it's really easy to accidentally kill the vampire lady. So you gotta be really careful that you don't kill her, and instead murder her whole family. Show that you don't judge her for being a vampire. You're cool with that. It's their... bigotry that's the real problem. So, you know, to them. But I started to feel like maybe this had gone too far when there's this really, like, dark quest you get later in the game. You go to a village on the eve of, like, an important wedding day. Like, the village headman's daughter is marrying some local rich kid. But there's this entire, like, really... like it's well written, but it is a dark subplot that turns into a series of murders as like the love quadrangle that sort of cleaves this village in half results in a series of like killings and then hauntings. But in the middle of that, Geralt decides as long as he's here, he might as well bed the sister who murdered the aspiring bride. And so once I got that card, and then later that character, in a fit of grief and shame, and of course being haunted by the ghost of her sister, sort of kills herself and becomes a wraith in her, you know, in herself. I was like, I'm not sure Geralt made the situation better.
No,
like,
nope.
I'm not sure that Geralt sleeping with someone involved in the situation improved things. Maybe this is a card I should have left on the table. But I got it.
You complete the set?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's you can't get them all in one playthrough, because you have to make some hard choices. But I did about as well as I could. Funny thing, though, about that game, it's also a game where other forms of completionism caused me to, like, it basically took me 3 tries to get through that game, because The Witcher 3 has one of those mid-game, it's not really a slump, but there are so many things you can do and so many things that are optional that it's very easy to just, like, kind of ruin it for yourself because you're taking so long to get back to the A-plot that you're just completely mired in collecting random sex cards or doing random favors for minor characters in the edge of a swamp for no good reason.
Doesn't Witcher 2, if I remember, I didn't play 1, but I played 2 at the insistence of Vinny Caravella, so someone else could talk about The Witcher instead of having himself talk to himself about The Witcher. The Witcher 2, like, branches in, like, a really weird way, right? Where you essentially have to, like, there's a halfway through the game, you make this big choice, like an alliance or something mm-hmm. like that. And then you essentially, the second half of the game, like, there's a version you just don't see. Like, you pick a path, and there's whole parts of, like, storylines and characters and content that is just, you will never see. You cannot unlock it. You cannot go back. Like, you just pick a path, and then you either have a save where you go on that branch. But, like, the game's, like, is very explicit. We're like, this is like a road of no return. And it's not just an end game decision. Like, ah, here's the ending. It's like, no. Like, you're just not going to see huge amounts of shit we built for this game if you make this choice. So that was, like, really, like, a fascinating way, because most games, all games that aren't The Witcher 2, like, don't handle stuff that way. Like, there's some, yeah, you might not see a character or a questline play out differently, but they're not, like, going to say, you're just not going to see towns and characters and fights. That shit's all gone if you go down this path. And that game is, like, extremely unique in that way.
Yeah, if you play The Witcher 2, it has sort of this chapter structure where each chapter takes place in, like, a different hub area. And I think, like, after chapter 3 or something, the chapter 4 zone, you get one or the other. And so you either throw in with the Elvish rebels, or you continue on with your loyalist commando buddies. And it changes what that middle chapter is. And there's an entire chapter, basically, you sort of swap one out from the other. And that's very much to that game's, that's part of that game's theme, is that there's a lot of choices that are irrevocable. Does it again in the end game, where, like, you have to make some hard choices about which of your friends will be twisting and who you step up for.
That is, like, one of the most interesting things about this topic for me, is the way in which there are games that include that sort of exclusionary choice that then encourages a certain type of player, including me sometimes, who wants to see it all, to then say, like, oh no, I'm going to go back and, like, I want to explore every nook and cranny. But there are games that make me, like, go, like, no, actually, this is the one time. So, like, Undertale is a game that I really like and that I'll never play again based on, like, the conclusion that I reached. Because that game specifically, in a very meta way, is very aware of the player. And it feels like somehow a betrayal to that game to be like, all right, cool, everybody's chill now. I got, like, the best possible ending after, you know, replaying it 3 times. But I didn't see all the dialogue. Everybody get back in the box. Make me happy again. Like, that feels like this very weird betrayal of that game. But that's not the only, like, that isn't the only game that does that for me. Like, Mass Effect is a game where, like, I'm happy to replay it a bunch of times. But for whatever reason, I don't think I would ever want to replay Dragon Age Inquisition. I got the story I wanted from that, and there's lots I didn't see. And I'm curious, because, Patrick, you recently said Vampire also does the thing where it's like, there's more content here than you can see, because quests will just end, or because choices you make will lock off paths, and sometimes it does it well from what you've said, and sometimes it does it poorly.
Yeah, it's
But how does that make you feel all said?
Well, that stuff doesn't, like, it doesn't bother me in that way, because, like, I'm fine. Like, I don't replay games. Like, I 99.9% of the games I play, I consider, like, my playthrough to be canon, and I don't worry about, maybe I'll look at some stuff on YouTube, like, there's, like, big ending shifts, but I don't worry too much about that stuff. But with Vampire, it's part of its problem, and it's, like, sort of a flaw that's, like, throughout a lot of the games, so, like, interconnected systems, is it's just not clear how those systems connect, so that when you reach a fail state, you're not clear why you got there. Like, you're not sure why this system was talking to that system. And so when sort of a fail state occurs where the game will say, like, hey, like, you resolved this quest line, or, like, this... The way the game's conversation structure works is that you're constantly finding, like, letters, or a conversation with someone else will illuminate what they call a hint. And that mm-hmm. opens up a new line of dialogue with another character. So you're constantly running between characters all around the city, like, collecting hints. And then, like, that's a reason to run through another part of the city, talk to all these characters again, and you're building up new lines of dialogue with them. And that's built into the system of blood, and you use blood to upgrade your character, and the more hints you find for a character, the more, like, their blood is worth. And that's just a way of, like, encouraging you to, like, engage with this system. But occasionally you can, for example, the game won't tell you you're making a choice, and then you'll make a you'll make a choice, and then it'll say hint failed, which is the game essentially saying, like, this path is now, like, not is blocked off for you. But you're like, wait, was that a choice? Like, what do you mean? Like, failure constant is, like, insinuates you did something wrong as opposed to have made a choice that just this means this path is no longer available to you. And so the game's the language it uses is confusing because you didn't fail. You just chose to, like, resolve a conflict this way. And so it's stuff like that that is frustrating to me because or there's other instances where the dialogue, what you choose, is definitely not how your character acts. Like, there are moments, in, you know, the idea of, like, being very charming and suave is a very much tied up in vampire lore, and that is a part of this game. And there'll be instances where you can institute a charm, which is basically using, like, vampire mind control. You are not fucking charming. You are just tricking this person into doing something. But you can, there's, like, instances where you'll do charm and then do something despicable that seems counter to what you're trying to roleplay as or what you thought the dialogue would end up as. So those are instances where, I think what I've seen, a frustration amongst players is a frustration that the paths you are let down, the way things are resolved, don't necessarily feel in line with the selections you're making along the way, or things kind of come out of nowhere. But the game up front is very clear. Like, there's no save states. It is just a game that is constantly saving. And it says up front, like, the reason we structured the save system in this way is because, like, when things go weird or wrong, like, we want you to live with these consequences. Like, this is your playthrough. Like, we're not giving you the option to, like, have a non-canonical playthrough, like, unless you play this game again and try to make different choices. Like, the whole idea behind this is that you have to live with that stuff and the stuff that you didn't expect. Because even when you're making choices that are intentional, right? So, like, the way the game, one of the other systems are structured is that, NPCs are connected in social circles. So, like, you can pull up this big map, and it says, like, these characters are connected to these characters, and then they're connected to a district, and there's sort of, like, a person who's at the center of that district. And you'll encounter NPCs that are, like, very clearly evil. You'll encounter NPCs that are ambiguous. You'll encounter NPCs that are good. And if you want to power up your character so that you can make it through the story stuff, at a certain point you basically start making decisions on who should die. But when you kill people, that influences sort of, like, the status of that area. So it's like you'll, like, send it into conflict. There'll be more disease. And when you, in order to upgrade, you have to go into a bed, you pick your upgrades, and then you need to sleep. The only way the upgrades apply are if you sleep. And when you sleep, then time moves forward in the game. Gotcha. So when you're playing, everything is at a standstill. You can run around for as long as you want. There's no day-night cycle. Time does not progress. But the moment you want those sweet, sweet upgrades so that your claw attack does more damage, you have to sleep. And that's when the game goes, and now the consequences are going to start playing out. So that's what's really interesting. And I think the way it locks stuff off is fascinating. I think the frustration, and I'm curious if other folks have encountered this, is like when games, like, I'm fine with games locking things off, but I want to understand the logic behind it. And so then when games don't communicate their logic, I think that's when players get frustrated. And I think that's one of the frustrations with this game in particular.
So let's take a really quick break. We're going to take a break, and we're also going to listen to a very quick ad for the second season of Science Solved It. So stick around. We're going to take a quick break, and you're going to hear a promo for that.
Hey, guys. If you're enjoying this show, then you should really check out Science Solved It, Motherboard's show about the world's greatest mysteries that were solved by science. Season 2 begins June 26th, and it covers topics like chemtrails, Antarctica's blood falls, scuba diving flies, and even meat showers. Check out Science Solved It, hosted by me, Kaylee Rogers, with new episodes every Tuesday.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I I really need to play it. Everything I've heard about Vampyre says it's 100% my shit. And I respect it when games do that. I actually really like when games, even if I get frustrated, it's a decision I pretty much always respect. As a, okay, you made a decision game, instead of just making me feel like the most powerful person in the universe who can do anything all the time, I actually have to live with something. Even though I have absolutely been guilty of save scumming, especially in Mass Effect games, so I could romance everyone, because I definitely did that in every Mass Effect. You could romance anyone in. I definitely did a lot of that. Because,
well, in Vampyre, what people are doing is just they're save scumming by hacking. But they're going into the game's file structure, which is you can only do this on PC. Right. This is not something you. I guess you could upload your save to the cloud so that you essentially have one local and one in the cloud. But people are finding ways to do save scumming by like manipulating the file structure, even though the game is. And so I think that shows the lengths to which people feel actually uncomfortable with choice, even in a game that's saying, hey, like we are going to structure this so that you have to live with choice. And yet players are still going to find ways to say, well, but like, what if I could see it the other way? And there's only so much you can, as a developer, that you can do. Like, you can't stop people from going in and, like, you know, copying and pasting a save into a different folder.
Yeah, absolutely true. briefly, on sort of the point, Austin, you were making before about Undertale, especially. Most of the time, I am either... I don't waver too much in the middle ground. I am either... I want to play... something to 100% and see absolutely everything and see every nook and cranny and play with every toy and play with every permutation of every toy, which is me with Prey, it's me with Into the Breach, it was me with Breath of the Wild, even. I didn't 100% that game. That is a ridiculous undertaking to get 900 Korok seeds, but I came close and I got all the sort of extras to get the special ending and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But there is occasionally, very occasionally, something that feels to me like such a singular and special experience that I'm like, I played it once and I'm good. And that was actually Gone Home for me. Like, I never actually picked it up again after... playing, you know, I watched some Let's Plays and I certainly read a lot about it and sort of engaged with that. But I played it once, you know, the week before it came out. I put my computer down and I stared out the window for like an hour and a half, like in silence. It was one of those where it was just like, it was special for me. So I kind of want to leave it in a certain way. And there's been a few games like that, but that's kind of the big one for sure.
That is a particularly interesting example because that's a game that has secret stuff in it. Narratively, if you dig around enough.
The stuff in the base. I remember specifically around the time when that game first came out, Austin, that I think you got into sort of a public dialogue trying to piece together something about the grandfather or the father's...
The dad's dad. The grandfather.
It was one of those like C plots where you had to put together a bunch of information.
It's a great plot, and this is like the only bit of detective work I've ever done, but I cracked it. I was the first person publicly to crack what was happening with Oscar, and wrote about it, and then like got confirmation from that. This is like long before Steve Gaynor and I like would DM each other about cyberpunk shit sometimes. Do you know what I mean? But wrote about it, and that was super fascinating for me because the way I framed writing about this on my blog at the time, God, this was so many years ago, was like, I didn't want to write this about this game. I wanted to write about, like, how cool the queer romance was, or like, how fun it was for me that new people were experiencing this sort of narrative-driven, you know, game design, or like, how cool it was that a team that had worked on a Bioshock games had, like, moved on to make something without any combat. And instead, it's this, like, there's this really fascinating story about abuse and forgiveness and, like, and coming to terms with abuse. With one's own abuse, and kind of finding, kind of healing over time that is in this game or in that game, between two characters. It's kind of just completely in the background. And it's like, that game does not have an achievement for piecing it together. There's no, you know, it could have.
You looked at six images and then, haha, you've solved the Oscar mystery.
Right. Like, but they could have done the thing where it's like, if you figure it all out, you'll understand that these five numbers are important. And then you could open the secret safe, and then you'll really understand. And that will signify that you cracked it. And they don't do that at all. It's just in the background. And if you figure it out and you put pieces together, it is its own reward in that sense. And I really like that and would love – well, I mean, Immersive Sims, welcome to Waypoint Radio. We're going to say the word Immersive Sim. Tend to do this more than a lot of games. But also, like, other media does this a lot, right? Like, fiction is a genre in which – there are sorts of C-plots that don't necessarily take on the weight of the main plot, but can have a lot of importance to you as a reader. And I wish it's just the thing that games did more, because I think that example of Gone Home shows how well they could do it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to be clear, I spent like 4.5 hours in that single playthrough in a 2-hour game. But right, yeah, totally. Completely agree. I think that is an incredibly satisfying thing and absolutely like a reason to give that game a second thought, even if maybe I stayed away from actually physically playing it again necessarily.
I'll link that piece in the show notes. I'll give you the link to put in the show notes, because I think it's one of those things that like that no one talks about that plot line, you know? So.
Right. That was one of your first things that I remember reading. I was like,
oh, I think it was like one of the first times we ever talked.
This guy's smart.
piece it together. It's there was a divide, right? I could have gone on to become a YouTuber who solved game, who did like
Oscar explained.
Right, exactly. 100%. 100%.
And that was the growth industry. That's why you should have just.
I absolutely should have.
Narrative Sins with Austin Walker.
Oh my God.
Just the old family with a dark past trope.
I hate this so much, Rob. How do you just have this? Again, you just have it on deck.
And you're wearing like a suit and shades in each one.
I hate
like,
this. I hate this so much.
There's a skull in the background.
Yeah, in the background for some reason. Yes. Mm-hmm. For some reason.
And a bunch of like shitty, bad Stephen King novels.
This is America where you like, paid your rent for a year.
Listen, words have meanings, guys. And anyway.
I mean, speaking of words have meanings, we should probably go to the old question bucket here. We've got some really good ones. I have a couple of shorter questions from Twitter, and also there was a proper question bucket question as well. I think an older one?
It was 9th in the bucket.
Oh, my
Lord. Boy. So, all right, here we go. Will is relevant.
Vice Gaming's new podcast presents the question
bucket. From the top?
From the top of the bucket. Who is it from again? What's the name
Haley?
On it?
Harley. Rather, Harley from Michigan.
Harley from Michigan.
Oh, let's see what the data is on this.
I'll get you a date on this because it's not going to be good.
Piecing it together.
Okay,
Immersive Sims.
Okay, this isn't so bad. This is from November of 2016.
Right. That was a month into Waypoint proper.
What day in November of 2016?
November 5th, 2016.
Yeah, listen, close enough.
Oh, shit. All right, so Harley wrote in 2 years ago saying, problem completing games. I have a problem completing video games. To preface, I moved to a new state in late 2014. Before I moved, my best friends were my roommates, and I would play games on a TV in our shared living room. I don't know if it's the sense of having an audience or just having somebody to push me to go further, but the last game I can remember beating was Dark Souls 2 sometime during that year. Since I've moved, I play games in my bedroom alone. I still have fun playing games, but I've noticed a bit of a pattern. I get a lot of enjoyment out of Stardew Valley, Overwatch, Civ 6, Final Fantasy 14, Pokemon Go. Games where you can put in time without having to beat some kind of story or campaign. Since I moved, I've bought Pokemon Omega Ruby, Pokemon Sun, Titanfall 2, Witcher 3, Dark Souls 3, and I can't beat a single one of them. These are games that I know I enjoy, but there's just some sort of mental block that prevents me from playing them anymore. Any suggestions for getting over this? Thanks, Harley from Michigan. Oh, Harley.
Yeah, it's tough.
Harley set the bar a little high, though. I think Harley, one thing, if you really, really want to get over this, first of all, it's not necessarily a problem if you're playing different types of games. Like, lives change. I definitely have some, you know, I certainly have a lot of tastes that have carried through. But, baby tactics gamer, I started playing new types of games for sure. But if you truly want to have that sort of that feeling of completion, of completing a story experience, you might want to try something a little shorter than The Witcher 3 or Dark Souls 3. I guess Titanfall 2, maybe, that had a pretty standard length campaign, the 15 hours or so. But maybe something in the 6 to 10 hour range might help you feel like, again, only if you really feel like this is actually a problem in your life or you're missing that sort of sense of satisfaction. Just set the bar a little bit lower. Just go with that maybe and see if you can kind of go from there. What do you guys think?
I think it's a great way of handling it, honestly. Like, it's letting your side. I am the number one champion, or I do my best to be a champion of letting your taste change and letting yourself not complete things. And I even did that when I was like a broke ass grad student. It's why, like, despite people abusing the system sometimes, I'm glad Steam has refunds now, because there are so many games I bought and were like, I'm 90 minutes into this and I know this isn't for me. I guess I'll just eat this, but I'm not going to force myself to play through it. I do think it can be hard to be in the moment that Harley is talking about, where it's like, I know I should like this. I always like games like this. Why is this one not? Why do I not want to play this and want to go to it? And I think it's what you just said, Daniel, which is like, sometimes you're in a different part of your life and you might wrap back around. So I'd say that is like, there's nothing wrong with putting something back onto a pile of shame and be like, I'll come back in 3 months and try it again and dip my toe in and see if it changed. Like, so that's definitely where I'm at, like you.
Cool. Any other advice for Harley, or should we move right along?
Nah, I think that's good.
One more thing there, which is, sometimes you buy a game because you want to support something and you want to get something out of it. Don't feel bad about like buying it and being like, I'm just going to watch all the cutscenes on YouTube. Like, I can imagine being the... I have bought the first Nier. I'm never going to play that fucking game. But I will watch lore videos and I will watch cutscenes. But like, you know, like that's the sort of thing where it's like, I want this in my collection, or I want to support this. And there are times when I like, don't beat yourself up over it. There are times when it's like, hey, this is a thing I want to have, even though I might engage with it differently than grueling my way through 30 hours of something that I'm not in the place for right now.
Yo, but what if they did a remake?
They should do a
remake. I would play that. I would play Nier if they cleaned it up.
If they cleaned it up. But like, they cleaned it up and tightened it up, maybe. I don't want to. It's so long. Have you looked at how long to beat on that game? It's
well, because it's like the new one. You can't just beat it once.
But like, and also my understanding is it's not as much like the new one where each playthrough really
it's not
genuine.
Different. You're just playing. You just can hear. You find out the things you've been killing can talk, and then you just feel bad about it because you can hear the dialogue
for another 30 hours or whatever.
Yeah. I all I know about that game is the book thing. The fishing book thing that Justin McElroy published once, and I was like, no, I can't do this to myself. I get frustrated, you know? Gets in the way of my life sometimes. He was very mad at that book. I've
often wondered whether or not Justin McElroy was madder at the fishing in Nier or on Orlando, given that he wrote a song about both?
I think he did. I think that seems Justin. Right.
Just keep running past the arrows, man. It's not that hard.
It's not that hard. It's fine. It's fine. I like Don Orlando. Anyway.
That's very fair. We have a question from Aaron Boom on Twitter who says, how do you feel about completionists who are not necessarily into all the collectibles, but rather finding the secrets the game has to offer? And then linked the piece from The Verge from Patricia Hernandez. Now with The Verge, about Bloodborne and about sort of folks who have, again, like we opened up on, continue to plumb the depths of the game, which we already talked about a little bit, but it did make me think a little bit about speedrunning. And SGDQ is coming up really soon. I think it's starting tomorrow, maybe Sunday. Very, very soon. Tomorrow, probably.
I think it's tomorrow.
Opening on Banjo-Tooie, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing I've really enjoyed in my life without necessarily being engaged actively in speedrunning. I don't actively speedrun anything, although Into the Breach maybe sometimes calls my name occasionally.
You should do it.
We'll see. I don't think I'd be good, but, you know, I could try it. The point I'm trying to make is that speedrunning seems to be another way of sort of engaging with this. Yeah, go ahead.
Interesting about the Bloodborne one is I don't even know if that's it is a secret or it is hidden. This makes me want to go into like my like deep philosophy, try to find the right German word self, where it's like there is a distinct difference between, for instance, the final boss of the Chalice Dungeons, who is a specific character in the lore, who the developers put there for you to eventually discover and was hidden for you, who was hidden actively for you. Then what happened in this Bloodborne story, which for people who haven't read the story, there is a thing in Bloodborne called Chalice Dungeons, which are sort of procedurally generated Bloodborne dungeons.
They're made from like pieces.
They're made from pieces. They're like rune pieces that get placed together. They have a set of bosses they can pull from, a set of enemies they can pull. It's a bunch of pools that then kind of get, you know, you kind of dip your hand in one pool and pull out this weird boss who has two giant axes. Then you also, you know, reach your hand in another pool and it puts together a room where there's a poison trap or whatever, right? And what players realized was one of the high level dungeon types, there's a bunch of different like categories.
It's called Izzv.
Izzle. Dungeon was only pulling from certain subsets for them. Like, it's supposed to be able to have like 164 variations, you know, that you can extrapolate a bunch of different ways, but they were basically doing the same 32 variations over and over and over and over again. I'm really streamlining this explanation, but they then figured out how to get to that other stuff. And people, as they've described it, are pretty sure that this is not like, this wasn't hidden in this way for a special reason. This is just a quirk of the way the game was made. And that still makes it a secret, but it's a secret in this other way that, like, that things in the world can do this all the time. Or, you know, I feel like archaeology, this happens in archaeology. It's not that someone built a tomb and hid a thing in a certain way. It's like, hey, there was this weird crash and something got buried at a certain place or whatever, right? Like, that does happen, but it seems very unique to games in the speedrunning way that you just talked about, which is like, sometimes the way things are programmed, there are hidden things in there. There are secretive things in there, things you don't know about, things that aren't on the surface. And if you dig around, you can find it. And that's fascinating for me because it is so different than, you know, than something hand placed.
Well, and part of the thing about the Souls games is that, like, they don't generally, that studio does not explain themselves or their decisions. Like, you can go read, you know, there are interviews with Hidetaka Miyazaki, and there are art books that will sometimes fill in some of those gaps. But, you know, unlike a lot of other studios, they're not going to come out and say, like, well, here's why we did this. And so a lot of the sort of like archaeology of the Souls games is trying to understand like what makes From Software tick. It's how they structure their story. And it's also how they're like, the way they structure their storytelling is like, there's a direct line between then how players treat like digging into the game. Like the Demon Souls and Dark Souls are still, like, Bloodborne is not unique. Like, 3 years in Bloodborne is, like, actually, you know, 6 years, 7 years in Dark Souls, where players are still finding, like, things by opening up a debug mode and then, like, finding explanations for why certain things were cut or why certain decisions were made. And so I think a lot of, like, the specific From Software, like, Souls lineage comes from, like, just realizing that From is very deliberate in what they choose to include and to not include. And so players like pushing up against those boundaries and trying to find the explanations and why they chose to not include certain things, because there's usually a rationale behind it. So I think part of the way those games are structured uniquely lend themselves to an audience that then wants to sort of keep plumbing it in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. And even as a somewhat more general point, some of that is so fascinating to me because it gives you so much insight about how the game was made and how, what design decisions were made, what programming decisions were made, whether or not it was sort of by chance or this was the easiest fix at 11 p.m. on a Friday a week before shipping the game. Okay, well, we're going to put this random number generator in this, and then that creates an entire glitch. I spent hours last night actually watching Perfect Dark and GoldenEye speedrun explanations. Cool. that went into sort of the math of how lucky this one speedrun was, because in this Perfect Dark level, this one enemy will spawn in this place, and then this one enemy will clone itself. And if you can get this guy really quickly, this guy will clone immediately. And you can, and just how people find these things, a lot of times it's by accident, but it's just so fascinating to kind of see those seams and see where things have come together.
My favorite one of those is, and this is like so almost corny by now in some ways, because like it's one of those things like I assume everyone's watched this video already. And I suspect a big part of our audience has, but maybe not everybody. Everyone should watch the Half A Press video. Have you all watched the Half A Press video? Mm-hmm. It is by Panincoic 2012 on YouTube. It's called Watch for Rolling Rocks 0.5x A Presses. And if you just search for Half A Press video, you'll find it. It is a video about So you could speedrun games a lot of ways, as Danielle knows. One way is to do more than just try to beat it quickly. It's to beat it under certain circumstances. The most obvious one we talked about, 100%, where it's like, okay, if someone wants to 100%, you know, a certain type of game, maybe it's not just they have to beat all the bosses, it's that they have to kill all the enemies and maybe collect all of the collectible weapons and all of the collectibles and unlock all the characters and blah, blah, blah. But there's also ways that you can do it where it's like, I'm going to beat this game without ever, like, Dark Souls is, players do this a lot, where it's like, I'm going to beat this game without ever leveling up, without ever using a weapon. Extra difficulty. And so there is a version of a Super Mario 64 speedrun, which is, how do I beat this game with the least jumps possible? Hitting the A button the least amount of times. And so to achieve that, in the pursuit of that, this community realized that there are ways in which you could only press the A button halfway. That there is a full button press is a press and a release, and the game recognizes that as two different things, and so those are each half of press. And on the way down this fucking rabbit hole of figuring out how to make the least amount of jumps possible, you have to start to dig into the game and understand how it works, and start to understand that there's just a moment in this fucking video where he's basically like, all right, sit with me here for a second, because I have to talk to you about parallel dimensions and how the game, like, splits its main self into different worlds, and Mario has to fucking do these tricks where he's, like, passing through parallel dimensions of the main world that you're looking at. It's wild. And that stuff, again, wasn't meant to be seen. It isn't. I love Nintendo. Nintendo isn't FromSoft. I don't think that this is some, you know, deep treatise on the ontology of the Mario world. and yet, it suddenly gives this whole game this very, like, absurd, or this very surreal character in a way that somehow it didn't already have, despite being about a red-hatted plumber, you know, fighting weird little mushroom monsters. But, like, it really makes it feel that way. Everyone should watch that video. It's, like, 25 minutes long, and it's a fucking trip, and it's really well explained. Again, it's called Watch for Rolling Rocks, 0.5x A Presses, Commentated.
I'm sure you will then realize, if somehow you're not familiar, that you have seen this meme. Because half A Press became, and remains, like, a persistent meme in, like, game culture circles, and so, like, if you haven't filled that gap in, you don't have to watch the whole thing either. Like, if you just watch, like, the half A button press explained, you will at least get, you will understand where the rest of this video goes.
You should watch the whole thing. It's really good.
You should, but, yeah.
It's up to the player choice.
I believe that creator has other videos, too.
It's just amazing. There is just a fucking quote where he just says, but first we need to talk about parallel universes. And he's right. You do need to talk about parallel universes first.
It's very, very good.
Because the parallel universe is where Rob gets all of the cards in one playthrough and doesn't have to play The Witcher 1 a second time.
It's where L.A. Rob lives as well, in a parallel universe.
Yeah, L.A. Rob found a way to hack his save and get all the cards the first time.
Yeah, you know he did.
He just went on fucking Google image search.
He printed it out. It just, like, has them over his bedroom wall.
Not play,
like,
one of these fucking
why are they
games
so low res, man? I'm not getting what I need out of these. They're like the size of a coffee mug. I can't see shit.
There's
I need one that's wall scroll sized.
There's a restaurant not far from our house that has like a whole bunch of old timey sort of images on the outside, but they are clearly just like ripped from Google Images, because you can see, and like they're the size of like a whole wall, and the compression,
oh my God.
You can see the compression and the artifacting on the JPEG that they clearly just like handed off to whoever, whatever company you gave to like plaster that shit on your wall, and like it's incredible, because like and it's not like a consistent quality, like you can tell, like, oh, this one they actually found, like, accidentally they found like the large version of that file, and then like, oh, this one they had like the medium version of that file, and you can just see the compression all over the image.
I love it.
And it's my I can't point it out to everyone because not everyone quite understands like what that means, but like I had sort of like a technically minded friend over recently. I was like, okay, like this is my favorite thing to point out, because it's, you're just not going to believe that someone would actually do this, and the moment you see it, like the whole wall just like clicks into place. Like you're looking at like what are those images you look at and if you stare at a
magic eye image?
Yeah, it's like a magic eye. We're like at first glance you don't notice that like these images are this way, but the moment it's pointed out to you, it's like
I love it,
motherfucker. These are compressed images that they just printed out and made like the size of a building. It's very good.
It's fantastic. Oh, L.A. Rob has a magic eye. I'll just say that. All right, let's do one more. This one's a fun one. This is from Nick K or Night Del Sol on Twitter. Does the genre of the game affect your desire to be a completionist? I still have my drive for Metroidvanias, platformers, and Zelda games, with the exception of Korok Seeds and Heart Pieces from annoying minigames. But I don't have it for RPGs anymore. Do we have genre-specific feelings about completionism? Rob, you are nodding. I think Rob has some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, like, I am never going to... No, immediately I'm like, no, that's bullshit. I was going to say, I'm never going to care about, like, being completionist in platformers, something like that. But then Tropical Freeze, I, like, totally, like, hit the iceberg because I was like, I can't get the K. Oh. My level, I can see the K. I can't get it. Why can't I get it? This game is ruined. I might as well not play. So maybe I'm wrong. But in general, I think I do tend to get really... it feels... One, in open world games and RPGs, it feels like each quest, each mission, at least offers the potential for some sort of interesting story beat to happen, so I will go pursue it. Whereas in a lot of more action-driven games, platforms and stuff, I tend to be less motivated by the idea of like seeing every secret in a level. Because one, I know that requires a different level of like hunting for it. It requires sort of different eyes for the structure of a level than just going to a quest marker and doing what you find there. And also I just find it more exasperating than fun.
Sure. Yeah. And we all know how I feel about immersive sims. So those are my 100%. But, and again, it comes down to being fun to play with the toys. I just love to play with all of those toys in a good immersive sim. So I'm like down for 100%ing stuff, or at least getting very close to it. We'll see. You know, 98%. Sometimes I kind of use the phrase 98%ing when it's like, oh, there's one thing that just looks really annoying, but I'll pretty much get everything else. So, Patrick, sounds like you have a thought here as well.
Yeah, for me, it's like when I reach the end of, you know, I'll do like collectibles within reason. As I'm playing through a game, and then when I get to the end, if it's like not a huge lift, like maybe that'll be an incentive to go back. But if it's the kind of thing where it's like, I beat the game and like, I was pretty diligent about like looking around, but I only collected 30 of 300. And it's like, all right, well, fuck you. Like, I'm not going to go back and do that. But it's the kind of thing where it's like, oh, I've collected like 60 of 70. It's like, oh, like, okay. And like, maybe like they put some real thought into like hiding these in some interesting places and like, I'll be rewarded for like kind of poking around. And so, yeah, it's kind of like a, I don't know where like the exact like sort of tipping point is, but it's like a certain percentage where it's like I've reasonably found a decent number of them on like a normal thoughtful playthrough. I'll like try and go and sweep up the rest. But if it's the kind of thing where it's, you know, a whole nother excavation, then I that usually strikes me as, oh, those are not necessarily collectibles that are as thoughtful. They seem like maybe they're just junk to have you get an achievement.
It can actually go it can go so hard for me the other way, which is like, I know, Patrick, you've often talked about, Patrick and Danielle, both of you have talked about the joy of collectibles in games when they're well-placed, especially in platformers, whether that's 2D or 3D. The Mario series in Banjo-Kazooie, like, yeah, that is a big part of the joy in the Donkey Kong, collect the Donkey Kong Returns, Donkey Kong...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Banana,
you got it.
Banana Freeze. Good. Donkey Kong, yeah, Banana Freeze. Country.
My favorite
Donkey
ice
Kong
cream.
Country. That's the subtitle.
I like Banana Freeze. That's good.
Me too. It's summertime. I could go for a Banana Freeze.
Yeah.
I actually could. I'm not a big banana flavor person. Anyway. But in a lot of instances, that notion of like the draw is the collectibles and figuring out how to get them. Well, and I haven't like worked out in my brain why this divide happens, but a lot of times, like, oh, then that game's not for me. But in other cases, when I look at something like Captain Toad, or when I looked at like Grow Home, was that the first one? there, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going to get all those collectibles, because I think the moment-to-moment stuff feels so rewarding and so fun. And I maybe just don't get the same enjoyment out of most other platformers, but it will actually make me not play certain games when I'm like, oh, that's the thing that's on offer.
Yeah.
You know, which is, again, that's just a personal taste thing, not a judgment thing.
Sorry, not everybody likes a banana freeze. It's all right.
It's true. Cool.
Some people like pineapple freezes.
I don't. I like bananas.
Me too.
Do not put banana flavored things.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, like, is there anything worse than, like, you're at a birthday party? Okay, this happens more when you're a kid, but you're at someone's birthday party and, like, it's fucking sheet cake, and you're like, oh shit, it's like white cake with like chocolate frosting, or it's a yellow cake with chocolate frosting. I'm into that. Take a big slice. It's banana cake.
Oh,
and it's like, God damn it.
I'll eat it if I want a banana. I'll eat a fucking banana.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's fair. I've never had a banana cake. I've had banana cream pie. I've never had banana cake.
You're fortunate.
Are you talking about banana bread or are you talking about something else?
No. Banana cake.
Sheet cake.
It's like a yellow cake, but with banana flavor. Banana bread can be delicious as long as it's not too banana-y.
Banana bread's good. Banana bread, I'm here for.
Banana bread?
Not as good as pumpkin bread, if I'm being honest.
Like, I don't like pumpkin as much.
Yeah, pumpkin is bad.
Oh, I
don't like pumpkin things. I've never liked pumpkin. You know what I like? I like the process of making pumpkin seeds. Of like salting, like
pumpkin
getting them
seeds
out.
Are good.
Delicious.
But like pumpkin.
I don't like them. I'll make you some pumpkin seeds. I'll make that happen for you.
My divide with you is that, like, yeah, pumpkin seeds, fine. We'll put some salt and pepper on them. You put them in the oven while you're like carving out a pumpkin. A lot
Have
of fun.
Have a beer. Oh, love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Have like 10 beers.
Y'all want to come over and like
put yourself in the oven.
Pumpkin beer is amazing.
Pumpkin beer can go to hell.
No!
Pumpkin flavor.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the only kind of beer I like is pumpkin beer.
Huh.
That's it.
That's because it's bad beer, but you don't like beer, maybe. So like, this non-beer substance is delicious. Okay.
That's exactly what it is. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to defend my shitty beer tastes. Like, it's true.
It's okay enough like beer. For sure. Beer is a weird fucking thing that, like, I don't know. And I'm certainly not like
beer.
A hot monster the way Patrick is.
Wow.
Dude, look, you just can't
Lots
drink
of feelings.
You can't drink Tecate for 6 days in a row. A man has his limits.
Prove it.
I just don't understand. What could be better in the LA heat than a delicious 10% ABV stuff.
Oh God!
Nice and heavy, you know.
Yeah,
which is what you did actually when we got lunch.
Oh, that's true.
I love it when a beer is like a blanket. That's what I love.
This was a bad choice. Has one sip. Nah, this was a good choice.
By the way, the rest of that day, like, I crushed it. Like, I was on fire.
Yeah.
Next day, everyone is like, man, I'm really feeling it. I think I'm at the end of my E3 rope. And I was like, I can do this for another week. Where's my Imperial Stout?
God.
It gave you life.
Yeah.
I mean, makes sense. It all makes sense. It all comes together. I had a lot of smoothies during E3. I didn't have a lot of beer. I had a lot of smoothies.
What was the smoothie place you went to?
Oh, it was amazing. It was called Quench, and it was spelled horribly, but those smoothies were so delicious. And they had the good protein powder, the pumpkin protein powder. It was so good.
I misheard. I forgot that the word stout and the word stoat were different. And so when you were like, with my Imperial
Stout. What did you think I was doing?
I thought you had like
a
little
gremlin situation?
Like a little Imperial, like a little weasel hanging out with you that was like all dressed up like an Imperial garb.
It was his friend.
And my Imperial, yeah. Like,
so basically,
like, on my shoulder.
You thought I was just like living mouse guard the entire
100%,
week.
100%.
I will protect you, Your Highness.
Exactly.
It tracks. You know, we met L.A. Rob. I don't know why we didn't meet your other friend. But
Weasel King. Yeah.
The Weasel King.
Weasel King. Imperial Stoat, the Weasel King.
Oh, my God.
I love it. Okay, we should probably end this podcast on that.
Yeah, we're off the fucking rails.
On that note. Thank you, folks, for writing in. Of course, if you have questions, whether they're related to completionism or not, you can send them to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shoutouts, of course, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And you can read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. L.A. Rob, where can we find you on the internet?
At Rob Zachney.
Perfect. Austin, how about you?
Austin_Walker.
How about you, Patrick?
Patrick Klopik.
Amazing. You can find me at Danielle R.I., and I encourage you to be good and be good at it.
Peace. Sorry, I'm thinking about that stoat.
What would he say? What would your stoat say?
Peace. No, he wouldn't. He's a fucking imperial stoat. What would he say, Rob?
Well, how do you have a deep-voiced little guy?
You have a he's like down here, but he's still imperial.
He's in his little uniform.
Mr. Rob, I think we should crush the infidels. That's what he says, because he's like imperial, which is bad.
Yeah.
I stand for peace. Wait, I think it was Bane, though. I think it was Bane. It's just Bane without the fucking mask. You know, Tom Hardy, incredible range. Really,
just such good range.
I know.
I can't complain anyway. Including an imperial stout.
Bye. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.